This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Last month, I moderated a talk story event that focused on the question, does Hawaii welcome immigrants? The forum was sponsored by Zocalo Public Square, the Daniel K. Inouye Institute, and HPR. The panelists included Yale University historian Gary Okihiro, immigration attorney Claire Hannis, former Pacific Gateway Center Deputy Director Tarina Wong, and former Hawaii Attorney General Doug Chin. We shared the Honolulu Artistry Stage to discuss what immigration's role has been in the past, present, and future of Hawaii. We start out with historian Gary Okihiro.
The present moment is a vexed one, as we all know, regards immigration. At a time when the federal government separates children from their parents, cages people in cages that are so tiny and overcrowded, offering no toothbrush or clean clothing for children, telling women to drink the water from the toilet. That sort of dehumanization of immigrants, the vilification of them, has a long history in U.S. policy, unfortunately. But the present moment is also vexed within that context of history. This idea about the nation of immigrants, that the U.S. is a nation of immigrants, that we welcome immigrants, that diversity is strength and so forth, the Statue of Liberty is a symbol of that open door. But when the statue was dedicated in 1886, just 4 years prior, the Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, barring Chinese migrant workers from coming into the United States. So some people were welcome, but other people were not. In fact, before the arrival of Asians, the U.S. had no national immigration law because Europeans were all welcomed, but not Asians. So the first law was against Chinese and Japanese women in 1875. And shortly after the Chinese Exclusion Act, the Bureau of Immigration began. And so the whole bureaucracy around immigration came about because of Chinese exclusion. Now, if you were to ask American Indians if they welcome these European settlers, I think you'll get a mixed response from them. Most of them would understand that their dispossession was the possession of the nation. That is, the nation was built on dispossessing American Indian lands. Ever since the Organic Act in 1900, the laws that applied on the continent became applicable to Hawaii, right? And those immigration laws that barred Asians, beginning with Chinese, then Japanese, Koreans, South Asians, and Filipinos, were part of the legacy that became U.S. Hawaii's immigration laws, all right? And there are similarities also. While European settlers settled the nation, European settlers also settled Hawaii. And if you ask Hawaiians if they welcome settlers, I think you'll get different responses also. Maybe some among the alii might have welcomed some of them, but among the masses of people, they were worried that their lands were being confiscated, that their culture was being eroded, and so forth. Now, Hawaii became the kind of multicultural place, largely because of the sugar industry in Hawaii that recruited labor from around the world, mainly Asian labor. So beginning with the Chinese, then the Japanese, Koreans, Filipinos, all came under the auspices of recruitment for labor. And I don't consider that as immigrants or immigration, you see. I see them as migrant workers. And migrant workers sign contracts. They sign contracts for a limited period of time, and the expectation is they'll go back once they finish their work. That's different than those who choose to come and they intend to settle. Now, that's not to say that they did not settle, because many of them did, in fact, do that. So then they became settlers also. But their original introduction was through that means of labor.
So you've got the economic forces at play that actually helped to shape what Hawaii is today. You know, the last sugar plantation closed on Maui recently, and we're in a whole different realm, and the political climate is different. And Doug Chin, if you could maybe talk about your time as the state attorney general and what you had to do in order to deal with this climate and the approach to immigration.
Well, I think the climate that is probably the most difficult thing for all of us to be able to deal with in the last couple of years is just this whole sense that what seems so obvious is just not something that will even pass through some of the highest officials in the land. So to me, I mean, when I think about the challenge that the state brought against the Muslim ban and how it was eventually decided by the 5-person majority, I was really struck by how it was a 5-4 decision, right? So you got the 5 conservative justices voting one way in favor of President Trump, and then the 4 dissenting justices. The 4 dissenting justices, Justice Sotomayor wrote this very scathing dissent where she said, you couldn't have anything more obvious than a president who's saying that he's calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims coming into the United States. Like, how much more obvious can you be than that? And yet the 5 people in the majority were still able to somehow gloss over that and still somehow able to say, even though that's the case, we need to respect and defer to the executive branches. You know, perhaps they don't choose their words correctly, but they still have a priority in terms of national security, and so we're going to read in a little more to be able to work that out. So when I kind of apply that to just like today's events or just things that we look at today, look at in the past couple weeks with the impeachment proceedings and other things that happen, not just impeachment, but so many other things that happen right now in the U.S. government. I think that's what strikes me is that sometimes you feel like you're going crazy, like something just seems so obvious. This is so discriminatory. This is so wrong, and yet you have people up there who are in very high positions of power saying, no, this is not. It's just a joke, or they're not really being serious when they're saying that. This is really what they mean, and so I think that's the world that we live in, and it's troubling.
Well, share with us about your roots and what it was like for you, you know, given the history of the Chinese Exclusion Act and being there at the Supreme Court with this case.
Right. My mom passed away earlier this year, and so I'm only bringing up because then I actually have been trying to spend a lot more time with my father. One of the things that most of us who are Asian Americans get is my parents never talked about their time in China. I mean, they just never spoke about it. You know, we just talk about food and we talk about school and things like that. So I've actually felt very motivated to ask my father a lot more about, you know, what was it like when you came over? And he proceeded to tell me a very long story about just how when my parents came to move to Seattle in the 1950s, it was during the time when the Chinese Exclusionary Act was still in effect. And it really took a lot of advocacy from, it was actually a Christian missionary that kind of adopted them, really advocated for them, got them situated at the University of Washington, taking classes there. And so there was a major effort to get them to be able to do that. But, you know, I think that's really what I see is that for so many people, they're looking for that chance to be able to have that opportunity. My parents took a big risk. And as a result of that, you know, my sister and I were able to be Americans and have the lives that we had.
And Claire, you're from the Midwest.
Toledo.
Toledo, Ohio. And you do, you know, so much work, immigration work. Share with us, you know, why you got into this field and how you see the landscape today.
Mm, yeah. So I didn't grow up close to my immigrant past at all either, really. My great-grandparents were all from different parts of Europe. But I did grow up in a very progressive family. And so social activism and social justice were just part of what I was raised around. And I'm a product of the Reagan years, for better or worse. Those were my kind of formulative years in junior high school and high school. And so looking at the wars that were being waged in Central America and the refugee crisis that came because of that and how the United States was refusing to recognize these individuals as refugees because we were the ones that were causing the problems that were driving them from their countries in the first place, right? So we weren't going to recognize them as being refugees. So just an interest in that and then life with my now husband, who was a PhD student at the time at Arizona State, took us to Phoenix, where I worked with an organization that was a sister organization in the sanctuary movement, and was really impressed with the attorneys that I met there who were doing work around refugees and asylum, but also immigration in general, and thought that immigration law represented kind of the all the things that I was most interested in wrapped up into one area, social services and social work and international issues and domestic issues. You know, you get really deep into the lives of your clients, which is it's a privilege and sometimes a burden because you take that with you to sleep sometimes, but that's been my history. And so I went to law school here at UH and graduated 20 years ago and have been working directly practicing immigration law and then immigration advocacy, I think, is part of that mission.
And so how do you see Hawaii in this day and age, you know, as far as welcoming the immigrants that have arrived on our shores?
Well, yeah, and when we talk about immigrants, right, I mean, it's a super broad group of people. So, I mean, the experience of, you know, one of my U.S. citizen clients who marries a Japanese tourist is going to be very different from the Honduran asylum seeker or the Micronesian who ends up in removal proceedings due to bad choices. So I think we're probably... this discussion, we're looking at those who are more kind of on the bottom, right? Those who are maybe undocumented because they came into the United States with no status or they came legally and then overstayed, the vulnerable populations of immigrants. And then those from the compact states, I think, are, you know, again, in a different situation because of class. So I was thinking about this, and I think I would grade Hawaii as kind of a maybe a C+, B- in terms of how we rank as far as other states. I think there are some things that Hawaii does well. We have a limited purpose driver's license that we worked on getting passed through the legislature a couple years ago, realizing that federal policy, we could not make a difference in the federal laws, so we needed to see what we could do locally to make things kinder and gentler for immigrants. And one of the things we were hearing is people needed to be able to drive, or people were driving anyway, but they needed to be able to drive with insurance and not worry about getting stopped and getting cited for driving without a license, which would then sometimes lead to interaction between local police and federal law enforcement. And so, you know, a stop sign violation could end someone up in deportation proceedings. And so the fact that we were able to get that passed is significant and a benefit to all immigrant communities here. We have in-state tuition for DACA. Basically, you know, anyone, regardless of their immigration status, if they're Hawaii residents at the university, which is huge. We have growing legal social services. There was kind of a big hole in terms of, you know, there's no public defender system in the immigration court system, but now through the Immigration and Refugee Law Clinic at the law school and the legal clinic, which just opened out of First United Methodist Church, there are groups rising up to start to fill the need of those with immigration legal problems, which is significant. But we fall short, I think, in a lot of ways, too. We've not been able to get some kind of sanctuary-type designation passed. We don't have state-funded or city and county-funded legal services for people in removal proceedings, and some places do. You know, we don't have a large anti-immigrant population, but we have a lot of people who are very quiet, and that doesn't really do much to help either. So I think more people who are advocating for better immigration policies or for better conditions for immigrants here, this would be a good time to kind of step up and find your voice.
And I don't know what you're hearing from your clients. I mean, I just know when I listen to the headlines, I get very stressed out, yeah. Even though I have no major immigration issues affecting my life. But I don't know what you're hearing from your clients out there.
People are super, super, super stressed out. I mean, just a short story, a random phone call I had when I was in the Costco parking lot, and my work phone is my cell phone, which is maybe not a good idea. But I answered it, and it was just someone who just wanted to ask a quick question about naturalization. She was calling from the Big Island. And she was all concerned about getting her N-400, her naturalization application, in before October 15th, which was when this new public charge rule was supposed to take effect, which basically, you know, the administration, they can't change the laws, but they can tweak the rules to really, and it's class-based, which is connected to race-based. And so she was all concerned about how to answer this one question so that she could get it filed before October 15th, and I said, well, actually, the rules don't have to do with naturalization anyway, and the good news is that there were, you know, three federal court decisions that put a stay to that. She broke into tears on the phone. I said, are you okay? And she said, oh my God, I'm just so relieved. Thank you. You're my angel. Thank you for telling me this. I'm like, well, it's, you know, she wanted to know where she could Google it to kind of verify it. But that's where people are just, they're really, really, really on edge. And it's not something that people will talk about. And we all probably have friends who have friends who are living on the edge, of, and we don't know it because, you know, your immigration, it's not like you can look at someone and tell by their color, their age, what their immigration status is. But I think there are a lot more people living among us, probably folks in this room right now, who don't have a stable immigration status right now in the United States. And it is a very, very scary time.
You know, Claire and Tarina, you are in the trenches.
I am.
You know, share with us what you're seeing with the clients that walk through the Pacific Gateway.
I really do concur with Claire. Immigrants, refugees, and asylees come to Pacific Gateway Center, and I feel their anxiety. I feel their frustration. They come from backgrounds that are characterized by turmoil, by anguish, by uncertainty, and so they come here with hope. They come here with dreams. So what we try to do is to really do a lot of hand-holding. And we try to, through our strategies and through our interventions and through our initiatives, try to mitigate all of these challenges and obstacles that are presented before them. And we do it step by step by step. And even though there are a lot of details and the systems to navigate are so complex, you just have to be there with them and explain every single step along the way. And so the whole goal, I think, for social services agencies, as well as all of the stakeholders who are involved with the successful resettlement and transition of our immigrant population, is to give them a sense of belonging, a sense of strong belonging to our community, and to provide services with care and compassion. And so this is what we try to do.
And I think maybe folks, it would be helpful for folks to understand, because you see both refugees and asylum seekers. Mm-hmm. So what's the difference, and where are they coming from?
Well, you know, with regard to refugees, basically, I think the definition of refugees and asylum seekers are basically the same. They are fleeing their countries because of fear of persecution based on race, nationality, religion, political opinion, or member of a social group. The difference between a refugee and an asylee is the refugee is overseas, and they need to apply for refugee status to the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. Asylees have those same characteristics, but they're already on U.S. territory, they're already here, and they ask for sanctuary here in the United States for protection. The refugees have already gone through a very extensive vetting process, both at the United Nations level that goes through two or three vetting. And bear in mind, in order to go through the refugee process, it takes at least 2 years. Extensive vetting process at the United Nations level. Then if they get through that, then there's the USCIS level, I believe. And so there's maybe 1% of the world's refugees, and bear in mind there's about 70 million refugees now in the world, that maybe less than 7% get through to resettlement into the United States. And then what happens is those refugees who are referred to the United States by the UN, there are about 12 to 15 partner agencies, which they in turn have affiliate partners throughout the United States. Our partner affiliate for Pacific Gateway Center is the United States Commission on Refugees and Immigrants. So refugees do not just appear at our door like asylum seekers do because they're already in the United States. They have to be referred to us by our partner agency, USCRI. And then from there, the process of resettlement is really quite complicated. There is a program called Reception and Placement, which is a federally funded program. And we receive federal funding to help resettle refugees. And we have 90 days to do it. There's a very prescriptive time frame, as well as there's a lot of very specific details involved with resettling, which hopefully helps to create the sense of welcoming. But just to give you an example, for pre-arrival services, we have to make sure that there is housing. Within the housing, we have to make sure there's a bed for everyone. We have to make sure there are linens. We have to make sure there are household furnishings. We have to make sure there are appliances and that each of the appliances work. We have to make sure that there's locks on the door and the windows work. If there are children, we have to make sure there are toys. There is a requirement for an airport pickup. At the airport pickup, if there's a child, we have to make sure there's a car seat. And this is how prescriptive it is. The first meal a refugee has when they arrive in Hawaii, it has to be culturally sensitive. In fact, for example, we resettled a Ukrainian refugee about 6 or 7 years ago, so we could not serve him a sushi dinner for his first meal. It had to be culturally sensitive. So it's very, very prescriptive.
How's the funding for that?
The funding comes from the federal government.
But is there...
And there's cash assistance that is applied directly to the refugee to help them resettle. And then there is also funding to help support the social services agency.
But is that funding dwindling?
Well, that's a very good question, because since the current administration, bear in mind that in 2012, U.S. accepted 75,000 refugees, and I hear in 2020 it'll be as low as 18,000. So for Pacific Gateway Center, the funding has ceased. At least for now, refugees to Hawaii is now in hiatus, at least from our USCRI partner agency.
Can you talk about a lot of our new immigrants? We have a lot of folks who are under the Compact of Free Association that come in from Micronesia. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of tension, I think, because you see them, you know, with the social services and the housing. And I think there's competition for services. Can you talk about what you're seeing with those clients?
Well, you know, I don't know whether or not it's competition, but this is where we could probably do a lot better with our Pacific neighbors. The federal government gives us about $11 million, but it costs Hawaii $163 million to help support our Pacific Island neighbors with social services. They come here especially for medical purposes. They have diabetes, kidney dialysis, that sort of thing. Those kinds of services are not found in their home country, so they come here for medical reasons. And so when Linda Lingle pulls a rug out under them and no longer qualifies them for our state insurance company, they feel totally abandoned. So that's why sister agencies and Pacific Gateway Center worked very hard to get them all signed up with Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act. So there's a lot of work that we can still do working in conjunction with wonderful organizations like We Are Oceania and others to help mitigate the many challenges that are faced by our by the Micronesian population who come to Hawaii.
And for folks who don't know, Micronesia is comprised of many tiny islands and different island nations, different cultures, different languages, and so everybody is lumped together as Micronesia. And we were talking Palau, Chuuk, Ponape, and there are lots of major cultural differences.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one thing with regard to resettling immigrants and refugees and asylees is the whole factor of they're all limited English proficient. So that compounds resettlement immensely. And that's why, thank goodness, we do have organizations. I know Pacific Gateway Center has a Hawaii language bank to help with interpretation and translation. But this is very true. I mean, depending upon what part of the island you live, it's a completely different language.
If you're just joining the conversation, we're broadcasting a Zocalo Public Square event talking about immigration in Hawaii. Guest panelists included former Pacific Gateway Center Deputy Director Tarina Wong, Yale University historian Gary Okihiro, immigration attorney Claire Hannes, and former Hawaii Attorney General Doug Chin. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Pacific Database, Chaminade University, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
Coming Saturday, November 16th, classical pianist Naomi Niskala brings a solo performance to HPR's Atherton Studios, playing works by Arnold Schoenberg, Roger Sessions, and Vivian Fine on HPR's Burzendorfer Concert Grand Piano. Presented in partnership with Ebb and Flow Arts, get your tickets now at hprtickets.org. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
This is HPR One, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Today, we share highlights from last month's Zocalo Talk story that asked the question, does Hawaii welcome immigrants? We shared the Honolulu Artistry Stage to discuss what immigration's role has been in the past, present, and future of Hawaii.
Gary, what are you seeing? I mean, you've studied, you know, this whole immigration thing, and you've turned the stone over and over. Given the times that we're at and the legal issues that you've been watching, you know, at our highest court.
Well, historically, I think what the lesson I see is that immigration laws, the United States defines itself. The immigration laws that encourage certain people to come, and then the immigration laws that restrict other people from coming. That defines who becomes citizens of this country. And within those immigration laws, then, are the values being held by those who pass those laws. Just as an example, the 1924 Immigration Act favored Northern Europeans, and as you went farther south, you got less and less quotas for Italians, Greeks, Turks, and so forth. All of Africa, all of Asia, all of the Pacific Isles had only 100 per year that they could enter. That shows the value of the leaders of the country about who they wanted as members of this nation. And since 1965, that changed with Asians and Latinx people coming to these shores. That was unintended by the makers of that. So I think the present moment, we see a kind of pushback against that kind of flow of immigrants. And again, that's trying to define who is an American.
And Claire, I know the stories don't always have a happy ending.
Yeah, that really, I mean, it takes a toll on me. It takes a far greater toll, of course, on those families. But any of us who are touched by their lives feel that pretty deeply. So, you know, I would encourage, we do have two full-time immigration judges in Honolulu. And if you ever have any time on Monday, Wednesday, the judges are going to love me for saying this. Well, they don't love me anyway. Mondays and Wednesdays, 8:30 a.m., 8th floor in the federal building, you can go to immigration court. And you can just, the court's open, and you can sit in on what's called, they have master calendar hearings, where sometimes there will be 20 people all scheduled at 8:30 in the morning, and it is a fascinating cross-section of humanity. And you get to, it's like their lives are super exposed. You get to hear, you know, they have to admit to or deny the charges of when and how they came in. Asylum cases are closed. But oftentimes, it's a strange system. If the person is seeking asylum or lodging an application, the person will sometimes have to say, you know, why they're seeking asylum. And that's in an open court, which is not the best way to do it. But there are
you know, the courts are backlogged. We've seen, again, we haven't seen changes. We've seen changes in the laws in that the Board of Immigration Appeals, you know, which all falls under the Department of Justice, they've issued some really horrible decisions under Jeff Sessions and now under Barr that have especially impacted asylum and have really curtailed the ability for people who were victims of domestic violence or victims of gang violence to qualify for asylum. And those are the grounds for a lot of the cases that we see locally and that are being seen on courts throughout the continent.
If we can maybe wrap up and go back to this whole idea, is Hawaii, you know, welcoming immigrants? We've got about a minute or so left, but has it been your experience? We don't have a Native Hawaiian perspective here tonight, but have you, know, you come across anything to kind of indicate that they are welcoming in the cases that you've covered?
Well, yeah, I've had, you know, lots of conversations with Native Hawaiians about, you know, the work that I do, and people are, I think, are the people that I've had contact with are very understanding of the reasons that people leave the places that they're forced to leave from. Even understanding that does increase the number of settlers here in Hawaii. I've had really compelling cases, one recently of a woman who was almost 100% Hawaiian from the Big Island, who was married to a man from Honduras. And to see the way that community came together was really beautiful. And this is where really it was like love conquering everything else. It was
it was aloha.
It was. I mean, in like really like in the purest, most like colorblind sense. I think native populations understand that people get screwed all over the world and do what they need to, you know, do what they need to do, and so they don't begrudge. Again, in my maybe limited experience, people who are trying to save their lives and do the best they can for themselves and for their families.
So a bit of shared oppression, I guess.
Yeah,
if you look
exactly.
At it,
and we're very fortunate that we don't have an organized, you know, anti-immigration militia here like a lot of communities do on the continent. I mean, we have the you know, the yahoos here and there, and some of the comments in the newspaper will often be really, really negative and ugly. And I mean, I think you scratch the surface like a lot of things in Hawaii, and there is a lot of racism and prejudice, but at least, you know, you don't have people, when we've had pro-immigrant marches, there's no anti-immigrant counter-march. So I think that speaks well of where we are.
This is The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. We've been sharing highlights from the Sokolo Public Square discussion that was recorded live at the Honolulu Artistry in Kaka'ako. Toward the end of the evening, we took audience member questions.
One of the most abhorrent policies with this administration in regards to immigration is the detention of the children. And it's just, you know, devastating and unacceptable. And, you know, I mean, couldn't something be done about this much more quickly than it's happening, even at the United Nations and basic human dignity? And it's just so devastating to these children for the rest of their lives. It's just unacceptable. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the damage that's being done to them is going to... to them and to their families, you know, live on for generations. And it's, you know, I have two kids. I have a 16-year-old now and an 18-year-old, and they hear us talk about these issues all the time, and they hear it on the news. And I know we lived in Australia for a while, and Australia has a horrible policy towards keeping refugees from ever reaching the shore. And I thought when we lived in Melbourne, like, why isn't everybody in the street all the day, like every day, about this? Because it's so horrible. This where people are, you know, sewing their lips shut and burning themselves just because out of the desperation. And then look what we're doing here. And, you know, we've it's been challenged. We've been in the streets. I think, you know, we should all be in the streets a lot more. But I think for my kids, like how they're growing up seeing all these things happen and see like how power, you know, what kind of democracy is, how powerless we are, because it's criminal what the United States is doing. And we're in a little bubble here in Hawaii. We're away from the border. It's not in our faces at all. But the policies that are also forcing asylum seekers to, you know, Guatemalan asylum seeker to seek asylum in like El Salvador or in Mexico. I mean, it's just, yeah, I don't know. I mean, give money to the ACLU. I mean, there are groups. It has to get challenged through elections and through the courts, or we have to start burning things.
I have a 5-second answer, which is just the international law process is very, very slow. So I think that's why, even though those forums exist, it's almost faster, yeah, more efficient, if it's relatively more efficient, to be able to take these other routes.
I'm just wondering why there is so much discrimination against Micronesians in our Hawaiian society, and what we can do about it, or what are things that we are doing about now, and why are we falling short there?
Well, one of the reasons might be, you know, I've talked to some Micronesians who are active in the community, and we have talked about better preparing Micronesians before they come and giving them an orientation as to what to expect, what the cultural values and the cultural norms are, because a lot of it, I think, is due to a lot of cultural misunderstanding, cultural conflicts between our norms of behavior and what their norms of behavior are. I can give you a very specific example. We received a call at Pacific Gateway Center from one of our city council people, and she received a call from a constituent with regard to Micronesians in his apartment complex that are making way too much noise. Way too much noise, and they had people parking all over. And so she was wondering, well, is there any cultural reason that we should know about that might explain this kind of behavior? And so one of the advantages of being in the trenches is that we're very close to these ethnic groups, and we're trusted amongst them. And when I talked to one of our Chukis members, she indicated that many times, and in this particular case, there was a death in the family, and it is a cultural practice for every specific village to go at any time and to sing to the family to help provide them with comfort and with strength. And apparently this is what was happening. And so when you understand the cultural reason behind some of these behaviors and actions, you begin to be more empathetic and sympathetic. I know for me, initially it was sort of the cultural misunderstanding piece that plays a role.
There's always a group at the bottom, right? And now it's the Micronesians. And then, of course, you know, with the houseless issues that we have here and the lack of affordable housing, and that's something that's going to hit a population that's, you know, economically desperate, as a lot of those folks are. So they're visible, and that makes it easy to be the group to poke at.
And the general question is, how come Hawaii, since we've learned with the Chinese, Japanese, and all the other iterations before, how come Hawaii doesn't have an established process for the latest ethnic wave? So right now, I kind of imagine like what the Irish, I'm not Irish, what they went through as they came through, and that's what I correlated to. But just like the Micronesians and Marshallese and everybody in that area are the latest wave. If you go to any restaurant in the back house, you see a lot of people working that are cooking food for people to eat, and they don't understand that some of that food is being cooked by people that are looked down upon, but they're enjoying the meals and they're paying the prices that they pay over there. That was the point that I wanted to make, but the guy got it before me. The other thing was sanctuary status is, I think we are spoiled by isolation, because if people could get here, there would be like the ultimate Logan's Run, and you have to Google that for that reference there. The question is, how come we don't have it established when we've experienced the immigration process? Because what I see from you, Ms. Tarina, is you're helping to navigate the process, but we, in the military, they establish SOPs and all that kind of stuff with lessons learned and all that kind of good stuff. But thank you for illustrating the iceberg that we're all experiencing, but how come we can't get the heads together? And nothing is easy, so that's the softball question.
I do know that it's very difficult, and resettlement is very complex, and it requires everybody in the community. It requires, you know, education, it requires health, it requires the government, it requires everyone. And so, you know, I know there is an interagency council, which includes all of the major stakeholders who are responsible for helping to resettle immigrants and refugees, coming together to talk about issues, seeing what policies we can come up with to introduce into the legislature. But I know it's I really don't have an adequate answer for that.
Can I just add something? I remember I was talking recently with Esther Kiaina, and she's done a lot of work with the Micronesian community, and she shared with me that she was in, Arkansas, where they have a large Micronesian community, and she actually went into a bar where the Micronesians had to enter, through a back door. And so the bar had basically a curtain, and there was a front room where everybody else could enter, but the Micronesians, who many of them worked at the chicken plant, the Tyson's chicken plant there, they had to enter through the back door. So, I mean, it's startling to think that that still happens in this day and age.
I want to, first of all, say that I'm extremely grateful to have the depth and the seriousness of the conversation today, because there've been a lot of other great sessions, but it's never really tackled the hard issues in a way that I think is happening tonight. So I do want to express to the Daniel K. Noy Institute and to Zocalo that how important it is to have these kinds of conversations. The second thing I want to say is, to a certain extent, I think we're presuming this issue of people wanting to come to Hawaii as opposed to staying where they are, but federal policies have created an unsustainable situation where they can no longer be there. And so for some of them, it's not a choice, right? They would prefer to live in Chuuk or Yap, right? So my question is, you know, for example, Papa Mao, when he became ill, knowing that he had to go on dialysis, if he stayed here, it was a death sentence away from his home. He chose to go home even though there was no services, right? So my question is, are we focusing in the wrong place? How do we allow other communities to rise and to be sustainable? Because for a lot of them, that's where they would choose to live, that's right? So we all wanna live where we belong. I think the fallacy is assuming everybody wants to come here and we have to address that problem. How do we help people stay where they want to be?
And I should probably mention Papa Mao, for folks who don't know, is Mau Pialuk. He was a navigator in Micronesia who held onto this tradition of navigating by the stars. And he came to Hawaii and helped to educate our interested minds, you know, like Nainoa Thompson. And passing on that bit of knowledge from the Pacific navigators, that's something that should be celebrated. And it's a tremendous thing that the Hawaiian culture has, blossomed with this renaissance. It's just amazing with the language and the navigation. But Papa Mao from Micronesia shared that bit of information with Hawaii, and we have him to thank for. We have Micronesia to thank for.
But I think that it's really important, the push-pull factors, right? And so the factors that most of my clients absolutely would rather stay where they were born if they could, if there was opportunity, if there was safety, but there's not, right? Yeah. So, you know, I always think, well, until we even out the global economic system, that's the reality. And I don't see that happening anytime soon. So then people are going to continue doing what they have to do to survive. And that's, that's a tragedy that people can't live where they were born, because the things that people give up to come, the risks that they take, I don't know if I would have the courage to do that. I mean, when I've met people, and a lot of my clients are undocumented, and I think like they're heroes to me. Like, would I have had the strength to be able to make those that choice to leave everything behind and to come to a place where I'm not wanted, but to do that so that my mom could have the medications that she needs, or so that my little sister could go to school.
I was gonna say, I think it goes to us thinking about what's our role, what's our role as Americans? You know, like, in other words, are we isolationist and we just want to take care of ourselves and not think about, you know, just basically close our borders, don't take care of anybody else, because we have so many problems that we need to take care of at home? Or are we, you know, is what it means to be an American is that we're gonna be, I think the theory would be that we would be exerting leadership by being able to take care of other cultures and to be able to help them to all thrive and do better. So I think that's a much deeper question. I think it even goes to, like, what's our even role as individuals? You know, like, are we just here to take care of ourselves? You know, or are we here to be able to, you know, help the people who are around us?
And I think it's important to remember that it's often the policies of the United States that are driving people from their homes in their first place.
One of the hard questions that we should all ask ourselves also is not to simply see immigration as people coming here, but what is the role of the U.S. and the world in causing displacement of refugees and so forth? What is the role of the United States in displacing people from Central America for them to come to the United States? We know that the refugees from Southeast Asia came because of the war that the U.S. waged in Southeast Asia. So I think that's one of the questions that we should also ask ourselves regarding the immigration. It's not just people coming in, but it's the U.S. going abroad.
Yep. But one factor I'd like to add, I was just reading this trend book, and let me just share with you that by 2048, 74% of the population growth in the United States will be due to international migration. And so it'll be international migration that's going to drive our population here in the United States. And especially with fertility and births in decline. So this is one of the projections that they see facing our country right now.
Pierre, my name is Abel Conan, and I'm from Africa. And thank you also for mentioning the role of the superpower in creating the mess that we're living in right nowadays. My question is about the relationship between illegality, freedom, and immigrant labor. Because after my observation, the only thing I can see is that people like immigrant when those immigrants are not free, or when their freedom is limited. First, for example, where in Hawaii, the case of Hawaii, it was contract labor. People can kick you out anytime if they don't like you and things like that. So they're willing to have you around whenever they can abuse you. Same thing for slavery. You don't belong to yourself. So what is the role of illegality or limited freedom in the acceptance of the immigrant?
Professor?
Yeah, professor.
Could he kindly repeat the question one more time?
What is the role of unlimited freedom or unlimited legality in the acceptance of an immigrant? For example, black people were welcome in the United States because they were slaves, they were not free, okay? In Hawaii, they were welcome here because they were part-time contractors, they can kick them out anytime. In South America, whenever they come here, whatever it is, they can get rid of them anytime. Their status is not really stable. So what is the role of limited freedom in accepting an immigrant?
Well, I it sounds like you're making your point because I think that's exactly what happens. I think that because I think people don't really have a problem with people coming into the country as long as their freedoms are limited. But the whole concern is, are they going to be taking what I have and just having that kind of selfish mindset instead of just kind of a more broad picture in terms of what could actually be accomplished by welcoming them. I mean, I think ultimately the model that we all try to believe in is the idea that it's actually the nation of immigrants and the idea that we're diverse and that we welcome everybody. That's what is what makes America so special and so wonderful.
Thank you very much. On behalf of Zocalo Public Square, I would like to again thank the Daniel K. Inouye Institute. And I also want to thank all of you for joining us. So please give another big round of applause for our featured guests.
That does it for today. If you want to watch the entire Zocalo Public Talk, we have a link to video posted on hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, find them all on the Conversation page. Just look under HPR News and Talk for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And to listen back to today's show, or if you want to find a past one, check out the Conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday for more of the Conversation.